In American society, money is a taboo topic. We're taught at a young age it's improper to talk about it, but we're also bombarded with messages about the power and importance of money in our everyday lives. And by not talking about it, we miss out on the skills and lessons we need to effectively understand and financially plan. That changes today. Welcome to Money Tales. Hosted by Sandy Brager and Cami Doder, Money Tales brings more than 35 years of combined professional experience in personal finance to demystify money and demonstrate what it's like to speak openly about personal financial matters. Join us each episode as they interview modern-day movers and shakers about how money decisions intertwine with their daily lives in order to give you better insight into productive financial conversations. Subscribe today and register for our blog Fathom at esperient.com/podcasts to increase your money mojo. And now, here's Cami and Sandy.
Sarah Harkness, a.k.a. Sharky, is our guest this week on Money Tales. Today we dive into Sharky's extraordinary journey where she narrowly escaped death, not once, not twice, but three times. Sharky shares the raw moments of facing mortality, finding strength in the depths of despair, and embracing a no-quit mindset. From battling through over 24 surgeries within 4 years, to shedding layers of shame, Sharky's story is a testament to the power of resilience and the courage to defy the odds. She emerged from this health disaster as a believer that resilience is the secret ingredient, abundance is the goal, collaboration is the default, and being a giant is the strategy. Sharky has been on a mission ever since to surround herself with others who share her mindset.
Here are three key money topics Sharky hits on in this conversation. First, the importance of periodic self-reflection to assess how she's investing in herself in a positive way and to identify where she's allowing fear of losing money to overtake her. Second, the importance of leveraging other people's experiences, learning from them how they've been smart about their money. And third, how facing death caused her to think about her retirement plans differently. We hope you share this episode with a friend, and please subscribe to Money Tales on your favorite podcast platform. Now on to our conversation with Sarah Sharky Harkness.
Welcome to the Money Tales podcast. I'm Cami Doder.
And I'm Sandy Brager. Cami, I am back from a trip to London with my family.
How was it?
Oh, it was amazing. While we were there, we visited the British Museum, which I've been to before. Have you ever been?
I don't know. I must have, but I don't recall.
Yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful museum. They have antiquities from the Western world and even beyond that. But what caught my eye during this particular visit was a piece of their permanent collection on money. And they had all these coins from Greece, Rome, and Persia from 500 BC to 500 AD. And I found myself captivated looking at the coins. And not just the coins, but some of the clay models that they had on display that were used to make coins. I was thinking about how beautiful money is.
It's so beautiful.
And how it's been around for thousands of years. And during my trip to London, I was there for a week. I didn't use any paper money or coins. I just used my iPhone.
That makes me sad a little bit. I don't want it to go away.
That's all I kept thinking while I was in this museum, like this beautiful money from thousands of years ago. It was really wild to think about. But yeah, I was just tapping my phone everywhere using my Apple wallet. You have to find a way to keep money beautiful as the world moves forward.
It was such an important part of travel when I was younger, and it was so special to collect. And I've shared my story about my daughters wanting each unit and the paper and the coins in Ireland. And it's just so special that you're right. It is going away. Let's work on that.
Let's do it. In the meantime, you can see currency in museums around the world. I'm sure more than just the British Museum has them. But this particular exhibit was pretty cool, looking at these molds and seeing how they had the coins. And it sort of made sense why some old coins have holes in the middle because it allowed it to be more easily placed in this clay cast and built that way.
So it's not so you could wear it as a necklace?
You could wear it as a necklace.
Well, it's appropriate you talked about this because our guest today is from the Commonwealth. Welcome, Sarah Sharkey Harkness, to the Money Tales podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here with both of you. I've actually got a coin.
Ah, isn't that beautiful?
That could have come right out of the museum.
I have one from Australia as well. I have a necklace that I have that my husband had made with Australian coinage. That's wonderful. Sarah, would you introduce yourself and provide a couple pivotal moments that have taken place in your life that really impacted who you are today?
I'm Sarah, or Sharky. Lots of people call me Sharky. It was my Salesforce alias 10 years ago. And I am a mom. I am an entrepreneur. And I'm also a bit of a hardcore resilience buff, if you will. I now trade in resilience as a service. And that is because I have survived some pretty crazy things that I'm happy to share and we can chat about. But I had 26 surgeries in 3 years, a year ago, and survived all of that. It was pretty gnarly. Brain surgery, resilience is my currency.
Unimaginable. Yeah, resilience for sure. Well, Sharky, we're going to get there. Wow. But before we do, would you share a little bit about your upbringing and particularly when money started having meaning to you?
I started working when I was 13 in Adelaide, South Australia. It's a very small country town, really. Everyone, there's 2 degrees of separation. There's no hiding in Adelaide. And I went to an all-girls school. And when I was 13, I actually started my first job was the graveyard shift, which was Friday and Saturday nights from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. at what would be your Burger King, but it was Hungry Jack's. So I earned $5.34 an hour, but at 13, that was big bucks. I didn't have to pay tax. That's how little I earned.
You were allowed under local law to work at those hours?
Yep.
Pretty amazing. What were you doing with your earnings, Sarah?
Some of it I actually reinvested into drama classes, which then led a whole other pathway. But I reinvested it into things like joining this drama team and being part of the local theater scene because I was really passionate about that.
Reinvesting, though, you use that word, which I appreciate. Were you part of a family that talked about money?
Well, my dad was a minister, my mum was a nurse. So money was tight in our family. I never grew up with huge amounts of it, but it was always something that as a part of our family was appreciated. So we actually really valued money from a perspective of the capability of what it could do. Every cent we had was going into a holiday or going into an investment or going into creating something for the future. There was never, ever a point where there was a disconnect or dysfunction with money because in our house, it flowed. It just kind of came in and I grew up that way. And subsequently, watching my mum, who then went on to do a master's and start businesses and things like that, I also had the entrepreneurial influence of her. And as a woman, that was pretty incredible. I really idolized my mum. And I worked from 13 onwards. I went and got a job at Blockbuster Video after that. And I even thought about opening a franchise when I was 20 years old. But I started my first business at 21.
What was it?
I had a stage screen company because, of course, you start at 13 in Burger King or Hungry Jack's for us. And I went to work for Blockbuster and I was like, well, I'm not going to go and wait to get a job in the industry of stage and screen and film and theater. I'm going to just do it myself. And I did not think twice about that. I got a $30,000 grant and I put my first play on in my company in Adelaide at a very small theater. Had an older friend of mine who had been in the industry come and direct the play. I acted in it. But I was like, why wait for somebody to hire me? I'll just go and do it myself. And I think that was because my mom had that mentality as I was growing up. She was just self-starter and in the health industry, very resilient. So yeah, I kind of just went, look out world, here I come. I'm just going to do it anyway. Stuff you.
That's a lot of money to receive as a grant as such a young person. How did you handle that money when it came in, Sarah? Do you remember?
I do, actually. I remember because I had to hustle, actually. I really, really, really love this part of my story because it's quintessential Sharky. I did a budget. At the time, I was also working full-time for a design consulting business as an admin. But I used the weekends and the office. They gave me permission, but I used the office and my computer to help rewrite the script. It wasn't my script. I didn't write it, but I rewrote it because it was not especially good. It's like a bad joke. It was called Birthday, and it was about a priest, a prostitute, and a virgin.
It sounds like a joke.
Oh, man. Yeah.
It was terrible reviews, but it was so much fun. By that time, I'd moved from Adelaide to Melbourne and, yeah, rewrite the script with music on and just spend that time creatively applying the stuff I was learning in business, being in this admin role, but then the creativity of all the stuff I was doing in the industry. And because I'd done a lot of amateur theatre, I knew the ins and outs. I'd swept floors from 13. I was in the industry, in the amateur industry anyway. I held auditions in my studio apartment in Paran in Melbourne, but I knew that the thing that would make this successful was nothing about the script and nothing about the acting, to be fair. Even if all of that was terrible, it would be the venue that sold it. I invested a lot of the budget that we had in getting one of the best venues in Melbourne, which was Chapel of Chapel.
Appropriate for the content.
Yeah. And we did a 2-week season. We were filled every night. We made the money back. And this little play then toured to Adelaide, back where I had swept the floors. So I'm directing and producing this play. I had actors that were in their 50s, and I just didn't have a concept that I was not capable of doing this. I just worked it out as I went. I really was like, no, I'm this unwavering self-belief that I could do it. And I fired actors. I think I was in part playing my own character at that time. I really was just like, I'm going to embody this, what I'd seen from being surrounded by these producers, directors, and so on. And so I just played the role until I believed it. And genuinely, it was one of the most coolest things I've ever done in my whole life, was to just create this and direct this play. It got made into a film. So someone came to see it and was like, well, this is a great idea. Let's get this on camera. I produced the film as well.
Of course you did.
Sharky, this is unbelievable.
So that was my first real job, if you will, in a self-entrepreneur, really, of my own stage and screen company. It was called Flip Stage and Screen. It's fun.
What'd you do next? You ended up in tech. I'm curious how you go from acting to technology.
I remember the exact moment, actually. It was, do I go and be a producer on this Christian TV show? I could produce things. I could put ingredients together and make something. I got good at that after working for Burger King. It was, do I go and do that? Or I had been working at Channel 7, which was in Australia, Pacific Magazines, Who Magazine, and that's who owned that in Australia. And I'd been doing a bit of admin for them and their marketing and sales team. And I found this thing called Salesforce. And I was like, this is 2007. This is Facebook for business, is what I said. Thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. I thought, whoever thought this, to make an interface that was as fun as Facebook, because Facebook was just starting at the time, but then made that for a business to use for reporting. I was like, this is so cool. So I actually started to really get passionate about technology. And a friend of mine who'd come in who worked for Salesforce, I remember Thomas Oskapowski, that's his name, genius. He worked in their customer support team and was looking after our account. And he just said, why don't you just apply? So I applied for a job at Salesforce. I had not finished uni. I was the first person to get hired out here in APAC that didn't have a degree. I totally bypassed all of the rules as far as getting hired by Salesforce. And I ended up taking on an SDR role in 2008, and I didn't look back. So it was this crossroads. Do I go that way? And I went, nah, I had no idea about technology other than how cool the interface was and I could talk.
So you bring your excitement to this new role. How does it shift your relationship with money?
I was in my very early 20s. I was hustling before that. You'd take on different jobs and you didn't really know much money, and any money you had was going out. But like I said, I'd always used money for the application of things. I'd invested it in either a course or books or travel or anything that was going to grow me. And so taking on the SDR role where you suddenly thrust into an excess. If you were successful and I ended up going to club in my second year at Salesforce, like, you know, President's Club, so you're earning really, really good money. And it's as much money as you can work the results for. So you are directly tied because you're incentivized to perform. I would outperform. Like, give me a KPI and I'm just going to smash it. Are you kidding me? I'm driven by that. And I don't know why. It's just an innate, unlimited belief. I just go, oh, okay. It doesn't actually matter what it is. I don't have a concept of no for myself at all.
So it's the KPIs that really drive you. But tell us a little bit more, because you mentioned you're growing up, money just flowed. That wasn't what your driver was. Now you're in a world where there's a lot of money coming in. Did that impact you? Did that change you?
I keep pinching myself about this, sitting and having dinner with Richard Branson this year and going, this is a girl that grew up with a nurse for a mum and a minister for a dad. I didn't grow up going to high profile private schooling. We hustled. I grew up with the hustle. I've always appreciated money in relation to you work for the outcome, but to get and adapt to get smarter about that, I think that's come from the other people that I've then since surrounded myself with and looked at that and gone, well, what is it about their relationship to money? Can I actually draw the inspiration from so that it flows even more? And as soon as I kind of realized that money was not about what you don't have, and there's been many moments in my life where there's been a flow and then it ebbs and flows, but it's always mirrored my relationship to self, in the sense where I'm at the time will have been reflective of how little or how much in terms of the numbers, but the actual energy of it has always had a consistent flow. The actual energy of money in my life has always been, I have never reached a point where I've gone, oh my goodness, and you know, I've skated close to the edge, but never reached a point where I'm like, okay, I'm bankrupt. I've come very close, but never. It's always been about self-reflection and going, well, where is it that I now need to look at where I'm not investing in self in a positive way, or am allowing scarcity to overtake, or fear of loss of money to stop me?
So Sarah, this is so fascinating because you've been true to who you are, but you mentioned before that you've surrounded yourself with people who it sounds like have had more wealth, and you've looked to them for modeling. What were the things you were picking up from them, and what did you do with that knowledge and awareness?
Well, I think rather than trying to reinvent the wheel or the currency in this case, it was, I have a currency. And if I know that the value of that, then it would allow me to be in the right rooms with the right people who then can facilitate further exponential of currency. I'll give you an example. So going to Abundance 360 in March, sitting in the room with all these incredible entrepreneurs but had successful exits or had raised rounds in their companies. And it was something I was wanting to do in my own business. So I just went and spent time with the people that had the knowledge and the mindset, as well as the experience, and understood just being around them, seeing what they did, and then recognizing the patterns of what they had done to achieve that. That was really a big game changer. Knowing the decisions and the pivoting decisions that you need to make, you can't always have foresight, but if you can leverage other people's expertise and experience, then you're much less likely to fail. But that's okay too. I've done that as well.
It's not so much that you were using their experiences and your observation of their experiences to change your relationship with money, but you were leveraging the patterns that they used to achieve some sort of success level. And that's what you were modeling.
Not necessarily. Pattern recognition is a part of that. But having conversations with them about where they had been smart about their money helped me make better decisions. And that piece is something when you're coming from humble beginnings and you're just used to working it out as you go. The older I've gotten, the more I've invested time in to making sure I'm spending time with the right people, the smartest people in the room, so that I'm not having to reinvent and go and find that out just on my own. There are some incredible people that represent money in the most healthy, non-dysfunctional way. I'm not an especially big person on ego or using money for the detriment of anything or anyone. The way money flows is when you recognize the value of that energy and leverage that for the creation of more of it. That's a labor of love. That's not anything scarce or fear-based. So it's interesting, the richest people I've met, Richard Branson is an incredibly rich man. He's a billionaire, but he is the most humble, most beautiful human that I've ever met. He is softly spoken. He allows space in a conversation for people. To sit across from him and have him FaceTime my daughter on Mother's Day and be willing to do that, the pattern recognition, it's like, okay, well, what did he do in that situation that made him different? And why I think it's actually facilitated his success is because he stayed true to that his entire life. He's never changed. He is who he is innately, and he's unapologetic of that, but he's not an egomaniac about that either. He's confident, but he's out there talking about how he did this with dyslexia. He's built this thing from a place of humility. I think that energy has been something I've looked to cultivate, but also seek out because I want more of that. I want to project more of that as well.
Well, Sharky, it sounds like you have, and you've been faced with some really scary things in life, one being this life-threatening condition that resulted in 26 surgeries and near death. How did you get through that, Sharky?
Honestly, I want to say so many different things, but the ingredients really were three, I think. And I had this beautiful conversation yesterday about what was the pattern that I implemented or what was the things that I actually did in order to deal with this. I was thrust into that situation. If you had told me in 2019 when my son was born that the next 3 years after that were going to be the hell that it was, I probably would have gone and exited. If you had have known that level of suffering was coming, it's not something you would have opted into. But I just chose without question and without even stopping to make the choice that you just keep going. I nearly died 3 times. I remember being in a coma and not being able to feel or move or speak or breathe, but I could hear. And the will was still just as strong. I can tell you, I was still very alert in my consciousness and I could hear things going on around me. And I was almost having a conversation with people, but without being able to, I just felt the will to live was very strong. And I just wanted to stay. I just didn't quit. So I think that mentality, the no quit, that was innate. I was born like that. When you've got a mother like mine, you don't allow a choice to quit. So no quit, having that mindset. Even though I probably lacked a little bit of self-esteem and things like that, as we all do growing up in throughout all of those surgeries, I had to lose shame and let go of any level of shame. As women, I think in particular, we either carry it or we live with it. And I guess I was lucky enough in that whole scenario of when you lose your large bowel and you're faced with your body gives up on you, you have accidents or crazy stuff that is really horrendous, you lose shame. So I just lost all shame. I was like, all right, that has to go. There is no place for shame. So no quit, then no shame. So number three is find your people. But I had to go and make that decision when the surgeon comes in, taps me on the leg. I've just had triple prolapse surgery. He says, well, now you're 21 again. You can tell your husband, who was then ex. So I was like, oh, okay. Where are my people? Because they are not here. I'm going to go find them. So I literally opened my computer in the hospital. I did a bit of Googling around the kind of people I wanted to surround myself with. CEOs and entrepreneurs, and where are the people with the mindset like mine? this is the pits. There's no one around me that is reflective of where I feel like what I've had to do. So I wanted to go find my people. And that's when I joined Abundance 360 from a hospital bed and didn't look back. So from then on, it was just, all right, well, who else is my people? And what else do I want to do? And I wrote a bucket list of the things I wanted to do. I wanted to meet Obama. I met him in March. I went noodle after that. And I think that moment was a line in the sand moment of, I will not tolerate this for myself anymore. And I just didn't. And things transformed from then.
Sharky, this is an incredible story of resilience, of strength, of shedding parts of you, literally and figuratively, that you don't need anymore. What impact did this have on your financial situation and your relationship with money?
Money was absolutely critical. I had been put on a palliative program. So they had said, by October, there's probably not much else we can do and we can't really keep taking things. The last thing they wanted was the gallbladder and I refused to do that. But I was in liver failure and had gallbladder attacks. Like, it was really severe. There was a lot going on, really. When I joined A360, it was because of Fountain Life. And I had been looking for, all right, well, there's no other Western options for getting well here in Australia. I need to go overseas. And that's going to cost money. I actually, in true Sharky sense, reinvested my superannuation, like my retirement, because they had already said you're going to die. So I was like, all right, well, I get to access that. And so I did. I used my retirement or a portion of it. I invested that in a couple of companies. And I then used the returns from those investments to then fund things like Fountain Life, A360, and then other communities that I started to become a part of. And through that, I spent a very small portion of money on Dr. G, and he was the differentiator. Joining that 12-week program, within the 12 weeks of his program, I had become an entirely new person. And so a lot of the credit I give is to the giants that have helped me along this journey, and he was 100% one of them. But the relationship to money was, I didn't have a choice but to use the money I had to invest in self, invest without question in myself and getting better. And therefore, I backed myself so much that there was no other choice but to make it a success. And I think that isn't something necessarily I recommend as far as lose it all or anything like that. And I certainly didn't. But the return, you can't even put a price on that return. The return is my life. And so the relationship to money is, there is nothing evil about it. Purpose and profit is the differentiator. You can't have one without the other, and they are equilibrium.
Sharky, you've been to the edge. You've looked over the edge. And yet you still have this amazing attitude.
It's Aussie in me.
What's one thing you haven't done yet that you really hope you do?
On the bucket list, I literally look at this every day. I've got big dreams, big goals, but I want to take my kids zero gravity. I've got three kids. I have them 80% of the time. And I've already talked to my daughter about how the fact we're going to do either a Virgin Galactic or a SpaceX flight, but I'm going to do it. And I'm going to do it with the kids. It's bucket list. I've got skydiving on there.
Sharky, you are out of this world.
Yeah, I know. I'm from another planet. I can't be stopped.
Tell us what your next money conversation is going to be and who's it going to be with?
My friend Richard. He's coming to Sydney. I think we're hopefully through Virgin Unite. One of the most incredible things about this story is that when I made that decision to go find my people, I also made the decision that I needed to use the story for something. This cannot happen to a human for it to be wasted. I wanted to turn my experience into something. So that's what we've been doing through Project Lotus, is creating resilience as a service, because companies can use this algorithm and these learnings to implement resilient funnels, resilient marketing, resilient sales. It's not about preventing threat. It's about abundance. It's about, how do you create a funnel that's so seamless that your customers can't resist? That's resilience, I think. And I think I embody that as a human. I'm just teaching people how to do that in themselves. through my coaching, which is just one-to-one, but I mostly do it with the companies. And so I've been doing that with Virgin Unite because it's always purpose and profit. If you get that right, then the purpose is what drives the profit, because you are naturally going to attract the right people that fit your purpose. And they then need to be seamlessly taken on this journey with you in a funnel. And so I help companies do that.
Sharky, where's the best place for our listeners to find you?
I'm on Twitter at Sharky CEO. You can come find me, have a chat. I'm always out there tweeting. And I'm on Instagram as Mama_Sharky. If you want to chat to me about anything in regards to resilience, come find me at projectlotus.info.
Sharky, thank you so much for joining us on the Money Tales podcast and sharing your incredible out of this world story.
See me in space very soon.
Thanks for listening to the Money Tales podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, share it with someone you think would benefit from listening, and leave us a review on your favorite podcasting platform. Your ratings and reviews help more people find our podcast. If you're inspired to gain clarity and peace of mind about financial matters, don't hesitate to reach out to our team at Asperient. Go to asperient.com/start-a-dialogue, or you can email Sandy and me at podcasts@asperient.com. See you next time.